Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite program on Saturday mornings, heard exclusively right here on WEEB. I am Steve Woodward. My co-host, David Hensley, continues his global adventures. We may have to start a new segment called Where in the World is David? But I assure you that he is alive and well, and we will continue the program, and he will join us when his schedule allows, and it is a very busy, busy schedule. I can assure you of that, my friends. Well, we are going to launch the show this morning by, first of all, acknowledging our beloved sponsor, the Marketplace Restaurant and Catering. Since 1980, your go-to for breakfast and lunch. Especially now, breakfast is a big draw because of the introduction of out-of-this-world breakfast burritos, which I recommend. At lunchtime, a variety of homemade soups are always a highlight. And if you happen to be hosting a function, a meeting, or a family feud, or a wedding, and you require catering, well, the Marketplace can deliver to any size party that you might be able to assemble. And so keep that in mind, the Marketplace Restaurant and Catering, our official sponsor here on Taking Aim. Let's begin, as we always do, by identifying public enemy number one. And I guess this week, it's kind of a combo platter between an individual and a group. Many of you, I'm sure, have come across the sad news out of Raleigh involving the brutal murder just after the first of the year of a school teacher, a man with a long criminal history. What a shock. Broke into her home in the wee hours of January 3rd, and she ended up deceased. And he has been charged with first-degree murder and, of course, felony burglary. Would have been nice if he had just maybe made off with some cash and just left, but he had to finish the job in the most horrifying way. The teacher, Zoe Welch, was only 32 years old. She taught at the Ravenscroft School in Raleigh. And the saddest part of the story is that it could have been, it should never have happened. It could have been avoided. And why? Because if you look into the background of the assailant, Ryan Camacho, he has 24 prior arrests. To say he has a sizable rap sheet would be an understatement. This guy has been in and out of prison, charged, release, over and over again for years and years and years. And our weak law enforcement mentality that the Democrats insist needs to be somewhat restrained, because too much law enforcement can be, you know, racist and can be oppressive to people who shouldn't be pulled over by the cops or whatever you want to, whatever storyline you want to follow there. It's really unfortunate. And let's remember that right now we have leading the North Carolina government, a Democrat governor, Josh Stein. And what was his job before he was governor? Oh, yeah, I remember. Attorney General, the top lawmaker in the state of North Carolina. That's interesting. Right now, his attorney general is a Democrat named Jeff Jackson. It ought to be a Republican named Dan Bishop, but elections have consequences. And we also have a Democrat lieutenant governor. So all of the top positions leading our state and influencing the effectiveness of our law enforcement fall at the feet of these feckless Democrats. And the thing that really infuriates me about Stein is that he couldn't just issue a statement as governor expressing his condolences to the family of the slain teacher, Zoe Welsh. He couldn't have just expressed his condolences and offers to assist in any way her family going forward. He had to turn it into a whole diatribe about what he thinks is the root cause of an incident like this. Play clip one.
We have to do a better job with this intersection between folks out there who are paranoid, they're delusional, who can pose risks. Obviously not everybody with mental health challenges are a violent risk, but there are some who are. And we are not doing a good enough job treating those folks. There are initiatives out there. There are these behavioral health urgent care centers, BHUGs, that the state is now setting up, which would be very helpful so that if somebody's having a mental health crisis, 24/7, they have a place to go that's not the emergency department, because that's not the right place. Jail is not the right place. We need to treat folks. So there's more we can do in that regard. I signed ARENA's law. It is to trying to get more people who are at risk, who pose mental health challenges, to have evaluations so that we have professionals, mental health professionals, evaluating what's in the best interest of this person to help them deal with whatever issues they're facing. That's right for the person, but then it helps make all of us safer.
I love the way Stein references ARENA's law, a law that was authored by Republicans only after an innocent young woman was stabbed to death on a Charlotte rail line by another guy who had been in and out of prison and who had been sort of shuffled off to the side by the law enforcement mechanism in our state. So ARENA's law, don't take any credit for that, Governor Stein. You signed it, which I'll give you one brownie point for that, but that's it. He also talked about treating mental illness. Well, I don't think anybody would oppose the idea that we should treat the mentally ill, but why would you just automatically assign mental illness to this individual who killed this teacher in Raleigh? What if he's just a murderous thug who's been arrested 24 times and keeps getting released and sees no reason not to break into somebody's house at 6:30 in the morning? I mean, I don't know. Have you done an evaluation of this guy, Ryan Camacho, to determine if he's mentally ill? Maybe he's just a murderous thug. And if that's the case, he should have been in jail, not in her house at 6:30 in the morning. So please spare us the compassion which you lack entirely, I have to say. Well, as we do a weekly, we go from this public enemy, number one, to the public embarrassment, number one. And boy, you know, there's always so many candidates for that. Anytime a Democrat's lips are moving, they're either lying or embarrassing themselves or both. We know that. And the public embarrassment, number one, this week was delivered by a whole bunch of Democrats in Washington on a day they love to obsess about, January 6th. January 6th. So, as you know, 5 years ago on January 6th, American citizens gathered in Washington, D.C. to protest against what they believed was a compromised presidential election, in which somehow Joe Biden collected about 80 million votes, which nobody believes. They were there to encourage, well, for her, first of all, to hear Donald Trump and others in his administration and in his inner circle deliver remarks at the White House ellipse down adjacent to the White House and the Washington Monument. It was a very cold and windy and brutally chilly day. I know that because I was there 5 years ago, 6 January 2021, and I heard all the remarks down at the White House ellipse. But being a man of a certain age and not very tolerant to cold weather, I headed away and prepared to go to travel back home, and I never made the journey up to the Capitol that day. In fact, I ended up watching the proceedings from on an airport television, and I was really, you know, wondering what the heck was going on, because the crowd that I was with down at the White House ellipse was not lusting for violence or looking like people who were going to storm any buildings. They were kids. They were senior citizens in wheelchairs. They're people with their dogs. Many of them had traveled overnight from great distances to be there. Some of them didn't wear enough clothing. It was very cold and windy, and some were underdressed for the elements, I have to say. I kind of was myself. I remember buying a Trump stocking cap from a street vendor for some outrageous amount of money because I was cold, you know, to be perfectly honest. So January 6th here in this year, 2026, the year of our Lord, the Democrats up on Capitol Hill decided they wanted to lend their voices to the commemoration by holding, wouldn't you know it, a candlelight vigil. Isn't that special? A candlelight vigil. So they marched down the steps of the U.S. Capitol with their candles, and then they sang God Bless America, which I think is rich because so many of them don't believe in or worship God in any shape or form. They worship themselves. They worship power. And yet there they were singing God Bless America. I imagine there must have been a teleprompter nearby, because surely some of them don't even know the words, if I had to guess. But that was their little stunt on January 6th this year, the fifth anniversary. But as I was saying to you, many of us who went home after the morning of January 6th, 2021, and started seeing these reports of this, all this activity at the Capitol and Capitol Police firing rubber bullets at people and striking them with batons, and wondering what the heck is going on here. This was never in the cards. The whole idea of gathering at the Capitol on 6 January 2021 was to hear from a roster of speakers. It was a very orchestrated event. There were to be speakers, and we were gathering there in an atmosphere of unity to at least, you know, and everybody knew that we weren't going to overturn the election. Everybody knew that Biden was going to end up being inaugurated 2 weeks later. But, you know, we had to stand our ground and let it be known that we knew what they had done and we weren't happy about it, and that we still supported the president, the 45th president, Donald Trump, who, by the way, would have been easily elected had China not unleashed the Wuhan virus on the world, and especially on the United States, which crushed what was a roaring economy in early 2020, which derailed life as we know it on so many levels, and you know, set the table for the Democrats to compromise the election with all the mail-in ballots and the ballot boxes and the drop-offs and all the stuff that they were able to do in the name of safety, because there was a health crisis and they had to save us from the Wuhan virus. So therefore, they had to save us from normal voting patterns as well. And boy, didn't that work out to their advantage. But none other than one of our favorite commentators, Victor Davis Hanson, who, by the way, just had some fairly invasive and serious surgery, but is already back behind the mic. He shared his insights into what really happened 5 years ago on January 6th. Let's play clip four.
Remember, Kamala Harris, when running for president, she said, January 6th is the same thing. It rests with, it's parallel to, it's comparable to Pearl Harbor, 2,400 dead, or 9/11, 3,000 people dead. And, of course, how many people died? Well, we know five people died, but how many people died violently? That's the key thing to remember, and the violent deaths were one, maybe two, a Trump protester that was caught in the scramble and the pressure between the crowd and the police, but really one, Ashley Babbitt, a 14-year veteran who was unarmed and was committing a misdemeanor of entering a broken window. She was shot by Officer Byrd lethally. And then all of a sudden, we never really knew who Officer Byrd was. We were told it was a justified shooting. We never learned that he had a checkered record, that he was, you know, clumsy, lazy with his gun, that he was had left it and people had found it in a Capitol restroom. So they wanted to suppress the information and suggest that she was an insurgent. That was a complete misinformation. Then we were told there wasn't really any FBI informants. And Christopher Wray said he didn't know. And only with a change of administrations at FBI records come out that there was probably somewhere between 250 and 275 actual FBI agents or informants in the crowd. And remember that Matthew Rosenberg, the Pulitzer Prize reporter for the New York Times, had told us at the time in an ambush interview by Project Veritas when he nonchalantly was talking to someone he didn't know was associated with Operation Veritas. He said there was a ton of informants there, and he knew them.
Well, there you have it. You know, 5 years go by, and we start to figure out where the truth really lies. And you know, history is certainly going to totally negate the narrative that January 6th was a Pearl Harbor 9/11 kind of an event. That was absurd on its face when it was first compared to those tragedies, and it's only going to look sillier as time goes by. Let's talk about some of the things you might have missed in the past week that we were paying attention to very closely for you, and that's why we're here. Some teachers decided to walk out of the classrooms across North Carolina on January 7, a few days ago. I thought it was interesting. You've got, I don't know, 100 counties in North Carolina and many, many school districts on top of that. And this NC Teachers in Action called for this walkout because they think that schools are underfunded and teachers are underpaid. The same narrative you've been hearing since the beginning of time about public education. By the way, nobody mentioned that the current superintendent of public instruction in North Carolina is a Democrat named Mo Green. So rather than walking out of the schools, why don't you just get on the case of Mo Green and bring your concerns to him? He's supposed to be on your side. You voted for him, I'm sure, many of you. But here's the interesting thing about this walkout. 52 schools were involved, reportedly. 30 schools in Wake County, one of the bluest, most far left counties in North Carolina. So that's no surprise that you would have grumpy, angry teachers in Wake County. That's where they... That's where all the grumpy, angry people live. 15 other schools had walkouts in New Hanover County, which is down there in the vicinity of Wilmington on the coast. That is a blue county, which voted for Kamala Harris overwhelmingly in 2024, as did Wake. And then there were five schools from in Charlotte-Mecklenburg where teachers walked out. Well, of course, Charlotte-Mecklenburg, another of the bluest, the deep bluest counties in North Carolina. So all the predictable counties is where all the teachers were walking out. And, you know, they say they're doing it for the children. Meanwhile, the children aren't learning anything. Maybe there's a substitute in there to keep them from, you know, setting the school on fire or something. But that's about it. And just another pathetic display by these so-called educators, and a not-so-subtle reminder of why homeschooling and private schooling are on the rise and public education is withering on the vine. The only thing that's dying maybe faster than public education is journalism and newspapering. Just in the past week or so, we learn that the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, as of the first of the year, is no longer going to print a newspaper. They're going to be fully digital. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, known by locals in Atlanta as the AJC, after 150 plus years of publication. And then on the heels of that comes news that the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is entirely disappearing from the face of the earth. Apparently it has been digital for a while now, but they've lost so much money over the past decade or so trying to keep the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette alive that they've just had to shut it down. It's not a viable business any longer. And I remember very well a journalism teacher in college saying, raising the question to the class, what is the most important aspect of a newspaper? And everybody was like, oh, integrity, accuracy. He said, no. Financial health. The newspaper is not financially sound. You don't have a job and we don't have a newspaper. I've never forgotten that. So Pittsburgh Post-Gazette gone. Watch this now, the domino effect of this. I think you're going to see, sadly, going forward, more and more of these hundreds of year old newspapers disappearing. Meanwhile, I guess we'll be stuck with the New York Times and the Washington Post, these left-wing organs into perpetuity. But rest in peace, Atlanta and Pittsburgh newspapers. Meanwhile, something really shocking on the broadcast journalism side is happening at none other than CBS News. Now, you may recall that CBS News was taken over by Barry Weiss, a young entrepreneurial journalist who had launched a digital news organization called The Free Press. She was hired by Paramount to restore CBS News to some level of journalistic integrity. That's a heavy lift, but nonetheless. And one of her first decisions was to bring in a new anchor of the CBS Evening News program, long ago associated, of course, with the legendary Walter Cronkite and his famous sign-off, "And that's the way it is." But now we have Tony DeCoppel. I think that's how you say it. Tony DeCoppel. A young, you know, man with hair and looks for television, for sure. I put him in his 40s, probably. Tony DeCoppel. I think he came over from ABC. So now he's anchoring CBS. And if you were wondering if the tone and tenor of CBS News is going to change under the direction of Barry Weiss and with this new anchor, look no further than this segment from a few days ago on Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State. Play clip six.
Finally tonight, and only in America, the many lives and many jobs of Marco Rubio, the son of Cuban immigrants and a former Florida senator. He's now the face of U.S. foreign policy and President Trump's point man on Venezuela, all in addition to his roles as Secretary of State, interim National Security Advisor, and acting National Archivist and USAID chief. Whatever you think of his politics, you got to admit it's an impressive resume. And now AI memes have added to that portfolio, casting Secretary Rubio as the new governor of Minnesota, the new Shah of Iran, the prime minister of Greenland, the new manager of Manchester United, the head of Hilton Hotels, and highest of high honors of all, the new Michelin man. Now, back in real life, of course, these memes may not add up to much, but for Rubio's hometown fans, which are many around here in Miami, it is a sign of how Florida, once an American punchline, has become a leader on the world stage. Marco Rubio, we salute you. You're the ultimate Florida man.
Wow. CBS News saluting Marco Rubio, a former U.S. United States Senator, Republican, Donald Trump's right-hand guy, the architect of the plan to extract Maduro from Venezuela. And CBS News is giddy about him. I never thought I'd see that again. That was almost a little, even for me, a little too soft, a little too fluffy for a CBS evening news program. But what can I tell you? Certainly, Rubio has proven to be the right man at the right time for the job that he is filling, Secretary of State under Trump 47. And I think we will continue to see the impact of his counsel to the president going forward in establishing the legacy of this administration, the 47th presidency of the United States of America, ladies and gentlemen. Now, this is going to be a rather abrupt 180 from the just heard advancing of U.S. strength around the world and belief in our wonderful capitalist free market system, because as you know, unless you've been living in some kind of a monastery, the New York City, the once greatest city in the world, the financial capital of America, has a new mayor, Zoran Mamdani. Mamdani wants to be your daddy. He is a self-described democratic socialist. I don't like it when the Democrats call themselves democratic, because that is not in their DNA. Not by a long shot. But now New York City has their mayor, its mayor. Let's use proper grammar here, folks. And, you know, he's Mr. Sunshine and Happiness, and he's going to make everything affordable. He is going to make everything, if not affordable, even better, free. He is going to take control of the cost of living. He's going to come in like, you know, like John Wayne on a horse, saddling up and riding in to save New York City and all of its suffering people, long suffering, apparently, according to his estimation. And the problem is that he has surrounded himself with individuals who are more extreme than he is, if that's even possible. I didn't think it was until I heard the insights of his director of the Office of Tenant Protection. That's an actual title. So if you're renting a domicile, a dwelling in New York City, you now have an Office of Tenant Protection that you can contact with all of your grievances anytime, day or night. The head of that is a woman named Sia, as in see you later, Sia Weaver. And here's her view of what you and I consider to be private property. Play clip three.
I think the reality is that for centuries, we've really treated property as an individualized good and not a collective good. And we are going to transitioning to treating it as a collective good and towards a model of shared equity will require that we think about it differently. And it will mean that families, especially white families, but some POC families who are homeowners as well, are going to have a different relationship to property than the one that we currently have.
Relationship. My relationship to my home is that I own it. And if you come for it, you're going to have to deal with me. That's my relationship to my property. And that is sort of the way that we deal with property. I mean, if you go down that road, how long before the government comes to the farmer and says, we need some of your crops? Well, they're not your crops. Well, they are now because it's for the greater good. I mean, that kind of thinking can go so far off the rails that you end up with a level of tyranny that not even some Democrats would put up with, if I had to guess. This woman is so unhinged, and what she has said in the past about things like property rights. Even the Washington Post, in its editorial, had to do sort of a sarcastic, cautionary editorial on this Sia Weaver. They pointed out that on her recently deactivated Twitter account, the new tenant Zarina posted in 2021 that rent control is, quote, a perfect solution to everything, end quote, and bragged that it's, quote, a more effective way to shrink the value of real estate, end quote, than zoning restrictions. In 2018, she wrote of her desire to, quote, impoverish the white middle class. Homeownership is racist and failed public policy, end quote. The same year, she wrote, quote, you like that? There is no such thing as a good gentrifier, and described gentrification as part of a centuries-long process of white supremacy. So improving a neighborhood and making it more livable and more desirable and building a better housing for more people, what we call gentrification, is somehow nothing more than the ultimate example of white supremacy. And that's such a stupid premise that not even the editorial board at the Washington Post could sit back. They go on to write that how Weaver plans to navigate this little problem of constitutionally protected property rights remains unclear. But the elevation of someone with such ugly and racialized views into a position of authority in America's biggest city is fresh evidence that Mamdani wasn't joking when he said during his inaugural address that he will make no apology for what we believe. I have a feeling that this young lady is going to do everything she can to force him to start apologizing as she continues to open her mouth, and these things are going to come out that nobody with a brain is going to go along with, that's for sure. Well, of course, it's been a eventful week in Minnesota, owed to a citizen interfering with activities of Immigrations and Customs Enforcement federal agents in Minneapolis. We all now know about the woman in her SUV blocking a street who ended up with a couple to the head because she was harassing and obstructing federal law enforcement officials doing their jobs. And why is ICE in Minnesota? Oh, yeah, I remember. Because it's come to the fore big time that not only does Minnesota have a relatively large, if not the largest, Somalian population in the United States, and you've known that for years if you've ever traipsed through the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport or the mall, the famous mall there. Somalians are everywhere in that metropolitan area. But now it's come to the fore, of course, that these Somalians are not only good at not assimilating, they're great at stealing our taxpayer dollars by running fraudulent operations like healthcare and childcare and all kinds of care that they could care less about. And lickety-split, the U.S. House Oversight Committee has called a hearing over the past week to further investigate the state of affairs in Minnesota as it regards the Somalian community and all the shenanigans it's been up to that were, you know, initially exposed by a young investigative journalist with nothing more than a, you know, an iPhone video camera and a mic. We now know that these Somalian enterprises have bilked the state of Minnesota out of billions with a B, dollars, bilked billions out of the state of Minnesota. And so the House Oversight Committee is convened. A Republican member of the House from Texas named Brandon Gill comes face to face with this very sort of wimpy looking guy from Minnesota named Brendan Ballou, who is a former employee in the Department of Justice during the Biden regime, a special counsel to the Department of Justice. He was called as a witness in this hearing. Brandon Gill had some questions, and let's see how Mr. Ballou answered them. Play clip two.
Let me ask you, does large-scale Somali immigration make Minnesota stronger or weaker?
Certainly stronger.
Certainly stronger. Do you know what percentage of Somali-headed households in Minnesota are on food stamps?
No.
54%. Do you know what that number is for native Minnesota-headed households?
Well, to be clear, a majority of the...
It's 7%. There's a big difference between 54% and 7%, is there not?
Excuse me, sir. Could I answer the question?
Let me move on. We've got a lot of questions here. What percentage of Somali-headed households in Minnesota are on Medicaid?
I don't know.
It's 73%. Do you know what that number is for Minnesota Native households?
Again, you're using the phrase Minnesota Native households, but the number
is 18%. That's a... quite an astounding difference, I think we would
agree. Can I answer the question, please?
Let me ask you one more, and then we can go on to that. What percentage of Somali-headed households are on welfare in general?
I don't know.
It's 81%. What about, let me just ask you, after 10 years of being in the United States, what percentage of Somali immigrant households continue to be on welfare?
I don't know.
The number is 78%. So even after 10 years, 78% of Somali immigrant households continue to be on welfare.
So the Somalians who are entrepreneurial and run childcare centers with no children in them, collecting millions of dollars in grant money to do that, that's one sector of the Somalian population in Minnesota. Then you've got your deadbeat Somalians who just live on welfare and suck all the resources out of our medical community through Medicaid benefits. Let's review that stat one more time, delivered by a representative, Brandon Gill of Texas. 81% of Somalians living in Minnesota receive some type of government welfare. And after 10 years of living in the state, the number still on welfare is 78%. So in other words, nothing is changing. Year after year after year, they're collecting their checks, living their lives, buying their flat screen TVs, upgrading their iPhones, and we're paying for it. And the governor of Minnesota has been so exposed as being a bystander of this fraud and abuse that he had to suspend his campaign for reelection. Timmy Walz. You know, somebody probably had to tell him to drop out of the race. I doubt if he did it exclusively on his own. But the man who was, you know, purportedly going to be the vice president of the United States under Kamala Harris now can't even hang on to run for reelection of governor of Minnesota because of this Somalian problem that didn't just occur yesterday. It's been going on for, you know, decades. And it's crazy. And then I don't know how you come to a House hearing in Washington, D.C. unprepared to answer any questions, not even take an educated guess at him. Just say, I don't know. That guy looked like a, if that's who was working in Biden's Department of Justice, I don't know how any of us slept very well at night for those four long, dark years, ending, thankfully, on January of last year, 2025. Here's a pretty cool stat that that came on the radar this week. If I can just get my act together, here it is. Pay attention to this. This is they're going to tell you about the big blue wave coming in the 2026 midterms and how it's inevitable that the Democrats are going to win all these elections. Well, in North Carolina, it's going to be a little more difficult than ever before because here's the headline. For the first time in state history, North Carolina has more registered Republicans than Democrats. This data just released at the beginning of the year by the State Board of Elections show that Republicans became the second biggest voting group recently. Each of the two major political parties accounts for roughly 30% of the electorate. Roughly 30% are Democrat registered voters. Roughly 30% are Republican. However, for the first time in history, now there are more Republicans registered to vote than Democrats. Meanwhile, unaffiliated voters remain the largest voting bloc in the state, representing nearly 39% of the state's more than 7.6 million registered voters. The registration numbers, according to Brian Anderson, a political pundit, reflect a growing trend of younger voters who have historically skewed Democrat, becoming less likely to identify with any political party. While Democrats' loss is welcome news for Republicans, the GOP share of the overall electorate has remained relatively flat over the last 30 years. So the challenge to state Republican Chairman Jason Simmons and his team is to figure out how to appeal to this low-hanging fruit of unaffiliated voters. They can't all be Democrats. And if, I don't know, 2 or 3 or 4% of them vote Republican, that's going to sway elections in a lot of races. And if 10% of them, of the 39%, 20% vote Republican, then we're running the table. Again, at least in the state of North Carolina. And of course, you know, already the left, you know, they couldn't wait for New Year's Day to arrive so they could start banging the drum of doom and gloom about the inevitability of Republican defeats in the 2026 midterms, you know, at the federal level in the House and Senate, as well as the state level and right in your own backyard, folks, where you'll have important school board races going on in Moore County. And we've got some strong candidates who have filed to run for the school board, and we'll talk to them in the coming weeks, and we will let you know who they are and what they believe and why we need them on the school board. And I will digress for that just momentarily, and we'll get back on track. But there's a little something to get your new year started on a positive note. For the first time in state history, and I just love to say it again, North Carolina has more registered Republicans than Democrats. And as a refugee who lived for many years in exile in the People's Republic of Illinois, this is why I moved to North Carolina, because I want to be surrounded by people who love the country and believe in the Constitution and who believe in free market capitalism. They're called Republicans, and I want more of them around me and my family in this state. And now we have that trend occurring right before our very eyeballs. Now, I mentioned elections, and this is as good a time as any, I would say, to talk about the election calendar for the coming year, because, you know, we're sitting here in January and it feels like the things are just getting started and the election season is down the road on the horizon. But I beg to differ with that presumption, because here's the thing. absentee ballots for the 2026 primaries will be mailed in the coming week, starting on January 12th. So ballots are going to be in play for the primaries almost immediately. I don't know how some of these people receiving absentee ballots in January are even going to know anything about the candidates. I hope they do their due diligence and do some homework before they just start filling out ballots. I mean, that to me is borderline irresponsible. You certainly have within certain boundaries the right to request an absentee ballot, you know, if you meet the eligibility requirements. But please don't just fill them out and send them in without knowing who you're voting for the love of Mike. And then here's the next milestone, February 6th. So less than a month from right now is the deadline to register to vote in North Carolina. By 5 p.m. on February 6th, if you're not registered to vote, that's your deadline. So mark that date down and get on the ball and register to vote. Then guess what starts on February 12th? About a month from now, in-person early voting will begin. February 12th, that's like right here. That's a month away. So you better start paying attention to these races in your county and in across the state. And of course, you know, our representatives in Raleigh are running for re-election, Neil Jackson and Representative Jackson and State Senator McInnes. We'll be hearing from them very soon, right here on this very program. I will be promoting that soon. They'll be joining us in the studio to talk about the 2026 campaign season. So early voting starts February 12. You have until February 17th to request an absentee ballot. So if you're one of these absentee voters, that's another date you need to circle on your calendar or highlight on your phone reminder function, February 17, absentee ballot request deadline. And that brings us to Election Day. That used to be the important day, and now it's everything is election season. But there is an Election Day for the primaries on March 3rd, 2026. So there you have it. That's your rundown of key dates in this already upon us election season. And again, be an informed voter. Everybody has a right to vote, but really you have an obligation to vote as an informed voter. And it doesn't take a lot of effort these days with all these digital platforms, and all the candidates have websites, Facebook accounts, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter X. There's no excuse to be uninformed. Unless, of course, you choose to be misinformed, and that's a discussion for another day, and I would be happy to engage in it going forward. Now, let us look to the week ahead, because it's coming. Another week is coming. And in the week ahead, I think Minnesota, again, will bear watching closely, because this woman has been shot and killed by an ICE agent. I think we're looking at, this is going to give the left and all of its protest-minded individuals something to riot about and take to the streets about, of course. It'll be sort of like George Floyd 2.0 from the Summer of Love in 2020. You probably have tried to forget about that, but you probably have failed. So this is going to be George Floyd 2.0, folks, and more details will come out going forward about this. It is clear that this woman in Minnesota was not some innocent bystander. She was in her vehicle blocking the road. Now, if you or I, we just went out on, I don't know, Midland Road or any road in Moore County and just turned our vehicle perpendicular and stopped, you know, we would be charged with some kind of a crime, and we would be asked to remove our vehicle pronto, get the heck out of the way, get off the streets, and then come see us down at the police station. Any one of us using our car like that, our vehicle, would be in immediate hot water. So here's a person who essentially weaponized their vehicle. The minute you're doing something with your car other than driving from point A to point B and adhering to the speed limit and the stop signs and the traffic signals and all those things that we do sort of as second nature when we drive, the minute you use the car for some other purpose other than transportation, you've essentially weaponized the vehicle, and you're going to be potentially a target of law enforcement. I hate to tell you, but that's the way it works. So we're going to be hearing a lot about this incident and the forthcoming unrest that it will undoubtedly foment. Let's hear in clip five from General Michael Flynn.
I think that we need to take this very seriously, because the summer of 2020, because now the fact that you mentioned George Floyd and the relationship where physically where this thing occurred, I mean, the George Floyd incident really was one of the impetuses to start the riots of the summer of 2020, which resulted in I think it was 33 or 34 law enforcement officers killed, billions and billions of dollars in damages to property. I mean, these are the kinds of things that happen. And the left in this country is trying to work very hard overtime to destroy this country.
So that's General Michael Flynn, who was, a target of all the left-wing smear campaigns in the first Trump administration. Now he is, really still trying to recover from the legal fees and all that he had to endure simply for being in Trump's inner circle back in the 45th administration. I do want to just share with you some additional thoughts that I had about January 6th and the whole episode there. And basically, one of the first things that President Trump did upon returning to office was he pardoned all these January 6th prisoners. These people were hunted down across the country. Now, we couldn't find any of these illegal immigrants who had come across our southern border, but boy, could we find law-abiding American citizens who happened to be near or in the U.S. Capitol. They rounded those people up like Nazis in World War II era, door to door, until they brought them all in. Well, Trump pardoned all of them on Inauguration Day with an executive order. And let's not forget, folks, that they are free. Why? Because Donald Trump turned his head at precisely the moment when a bullet would have pierced his skull on July 13th, 2024. So now we have January 6th and we have July 13th. These are dates on a calendar, but now they're moments in time that are etched into history. To these, we added September 10, 2025. On this date, at 20 minutes after noon Eastern time, Charlie Kirk was assassinated by a rifle shot during a public rally. Many on the left, in fact, too many to count, celebrated Kirk's death, while others coldly told us he had it coming. So let's be clear. The left defends vicious murderers who migrate illegally into our country. Maybe they feel a bond with these people. But let us be emboldened by the spirit of Ashley Babbitt and Roseanne Boylan, who lost their lives on January 6th, Corey Comparatore, who lost his life in Butler, Pennsylvania, when Thomas Crooks tried to kill Trump in the summer of 24, and let us be emboldened by the spirit of Charlie Kirk.
Well, as always, we thank all of you for sharing Saturday mornings with us. For David Hensley, I'm Steve Woodward. We're back next Saturday exposing deception, corruption, and rhino imposters. Be